Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. Picture this dystopia. In the name of rationality, in the name of reason, and in the name of science, religion, if not outright outlawed, is at least then severely prescribed. Some religious beliefs, would be deemed so dangerous that those holding them should be killed. The concept of religious tolerance would also be an anathema. Folks would not be allowed to hold whatever religious beliefs they wanted to, especially beliefs that those in power deemed irrational. And parents could be charged with child abuse for giving their offspring a religious education. I don't know about you, but that sounds like something from the failed social experiments of the People's Republic of the Soviet Union or some of the Eastern Bloc countries and other now defunct Marxist people's paradises, perhaps. Perhaps. Yet the kind of society that I just mentioned would be the logical outgrowth of views being promoted today by an elitist group of writers and philosophers, scientists and scholars, men like Dr. Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris are at the forefront of what's been dubbed the new atheism. It's a kind of take-no-prisoner shock and awe or assault on any kind of theism at all. Here's just some of the books. The End of Faith by Sam Harris. Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomena, Daniel C. Dennett. Letters to a Christian Nation, Sam Harris. God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, by Christopher Hitchens. And The God Delusions, by Richard Dawkins. And as Dawkins says, and I've talked about Dawkins before in a number of my programs, if you want to see some of my programs called Excuse Me, Dr. Dawkins. You know, Dawkins is kind of the Muhammad Atta of this new atheism. And I want to read you one quote from him, because just to give you an idea where they're coming from, you know, he is all no holds barred anything. He says, I am not attacking any particular version of God or gods. I am attacking God, all gods, everything and anything supernatural, wherever and whenever they have been or will be invented. So, you know, he's not pulling any punches here. Now, there's nothing new, of course, about elitist intellectuals challenge belief in God. Okay, that's been going on for a long time. But there are some frightening subtexts embedded into their rhetoric. You know, a while back, even the New Republic, the magazine The New Republic, which, trust me, if you read it, it's hardly a fount of religious piety itself. In the New Republic, author Damon Linker expressed concern about what he called the illiberal and brutally intolerant proselytism of these new atheists. In fact, if you read the new atheists, among them are ideas that, if taken to their logical conclusion, would wreak havoc on the free exercise of religion. And so the question I want to ask is, who are these new atheists? What are they promoting? And what's so dangerous about them? I want to read you a quote here. Okay, listen to this quote. Okay, this is a little book called From Thales to Plato, Philosophers Speak for Themselves. Here someone says, as to the gods, I have no means of knowing either that they exist or they do not exist. For many are the obstacles that impede knowledge, both the obscurity of the question and the shortness of human life. Thus wrote Protagoras, and he wrote this about 400 years before Christ. And the Protagoras, this sophist, was just one of a long line of thinkers who, to varying degrees, challenge religious belief. We're talking about names like Aristotle, Lucretius, Avicenna, Benedictus Spinoza, Voltaire, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Immanuel Kant, David Hume, Bertrand Russell, and Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew, by the way, once dubbed the world's most notorious atheist, recently changed his mind and now believe God does exist. In fact, if you see my show on the Hope Channel called Flew's Flight, I talk about that. But anyway, in this sense, little is new about the new atheist's philosophical arguments. They've come up with really almost nothing new that hasn't been heard before or in some cases expressed better than them. So they're not coming up with anything new. You know, some of their polemics, too, get puerile at best. Let me give you an example. Here's Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, the God delusion. Let me give you a typical example of this brilliant atheist apologetics here. He writes, "A popular deity on the internet at present, and as indisprovable as Yahweh or any other, is the flying spaghetti monster, who many claim has touched them with his noodly appendage. I am delighted to see that the gospel of the flying spaghetti monster has now been published as a book to great acclaim. I haven't read it myself, but who needs to read a gospel when you just know it's true?" Then he goes, "By the way, it happened. It had to happen. A great schism has occurred, resulting in the Reformed Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster." Okay? Now, it's texts like this are, no doubt, why I remember reading one critic a while back and writing, it was an atheist. He said, "It's arguments like these advance, nothing that I, the village atheist, could not have made by age 14. And I think that's true. So we're not here then, we're not talking about the intellectual, heirs of Lucretius or David Hume, but rather we're talking about that they're more the heirs of Madeline Murray O'Hare. Now, this comparison with Madeline Murray O'Hare is, there's a reason for that. For decades, Madeline Murray O'Hare, she was kind of the ultra McNasty Mother Jones of American atheism. I mean, Madeline Murray O'Hare, she was this woman, she disappeared about 10 years ago, but she was one of the leading atheist apologists of her time. She was kind of a joke, really, kind of crazy. I mean, she had became so controversial that in 1964, Life magazine referred to her as the most hated woman in America. I mean, she just had this vicious polemics against religion, against faith, against anything, and she went on and on and on. I mean, she was just a little bit crazy and not really taken very seriously by those that knew her, but she had gotten some court cases and even went to the Supreme Court pushing her stuff, so she was very well known but not particularly bright. Anyway, the point is, O'Hare didn't just attack religion as religion. She went after the practice and expression of religion as well. And this is the point here about these new atheists. One doesn't have to read too far between the lines of their books. Or in some cases, you don't have to read between the lines at all to see something similar brewing in the rhetoric of the new atheists. Let me give you an example here. We've got Sam Harris in his screed, "The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason." Now listen to this. Listen to what this guy is saying here. He says here, "I hope to show that the very ideal of religious tolerance, born of the notion that every human being should be free to believe whatever he wants about God, is one of the principal forces driving us toward the abyss." That's pretty heavy. Attacking this idea that humans should be able to believe whatever they want about God. He's attacking the idea of tolerance. Well, if you really know anything about religious liberty, religious tolerance is really a fake version of true religious freedom. Oh, I'm going to tolerate your religious views. It's almost as if religion is a privilege that we're bestowing upon someone, saying, okay, I'm going to tolerate your views. That's not what true religious freedom is all about. It's like me saying, I'm going to tolerate your breathing. Oh, how nice of me, how generous of me to tolerate you breathing. But he doesn't even want that. He doesn't want the idea that people could believe whatever they want about religion. Okay, and now if that isn't bad enough, Harris says the following too. He says here, he says, some propositions are so dangerous that it may even be ethical to kill people for believing them. Whew. Okay, to kill people for their beliefs? No, see, it's one thing. It's one thing to restrict people, or I guess in some cases even kill them because of their actions. Okay, I mean, someone's going to come into my house and try to kill my family, and the only way I could stop them is to kill them. What am I going to do? And free speech in America, even though enjoying a vast and complicated bulwark of protection, you know, is in this age of political correction. It is being tested. The limits are being tested. But Harris is not just talking about action. He's not talking about speech. He's talking about restriction on belief itself. You know, I mean, one would have thought that Orwellian thought crime would have been taken out of the realm, you know, whoever would have thought that Orwellian thought crime would have been taken out of the realm of political satire and promoted by somebody deemed liberal or progressive. And of course, I'm talking about George Orwell's novel that he wrote in the 1920s or 30s called 1984, his vision of this future society where even thoughts were restricted. See, Harris here, Harris sounds like Thomas Torquemada, not David Hume. Now, of course, American courts have drawn a distinction between belief and action. You can believe whatever you want, no matter how absurd it is. But limits must be imposed upon by actions inspired by those beliefs. You know, you can believe whatever you want. Now, you're not necessarily allowed to act on them, which, of course, no society would exist. But you know, if you didn't do that, but that's a distinction that Harris apparently misses. And I guess question two, one wonders just what propositions he said would be deemed so dangerous that they're worthy of death. No doubt that they would be religious propositions, okay? Sure, that would be the ones. Now, lines regarding the limit of action and speech they've been hard enough to draw, okay? The court has been struggling for years. What are the limits between action and speech? But to extend those lines towards belief, i.e. religious belief, boy, that would plunge any nations deep into the scary realms that haunted George Orwell's fervent imagination. You see, in America, from the earliest days of the American experiment, the free exercise of religion has been deemed a right sacred enough to merit special protection. And this is an idea that Richard Dawkins can't seem to understand. Thus, he bemoans what I think he calls the weird privileging of religion in America. You know, he uses some extreme examples of free exercise protections and expresses horrors when some of these cases the members are allowed to practice their things despite the law. I remember when I was in religious liberty work, we were involved in the Santeria case, and it was when this cult in South Florida were sacrificing animals and killing animals, you know, and they took it to the court, and the Supreme Court upheld it. They upheld what they were doing. They just said, all right, they're not hurting other people. They're not harming themselves. They put some restrictions because people didn't like finding decapitated goats sitting under their park benches when they went to wait for the bus in the morning. So they put some restrictions, but the court allowed them to do that. Why? Well, the logic is simple. The American courts have widely decided to stay out of the questions of dogma and theology. Let me read you one of the most famous quotes in American church-state jurisprudence, and I just think it catches the essence of what we're talking about here. The law knows no heresy and is committed to the support of no dogma, the establishment of no sect. The religious views espoused by the respondents might seem incredible, if not preposterous, to most people. But if those doctrines are subject to trial before a jury charged with finding their truth or falsity, then the same can be done with the religious belief of any sect. The point is, in other words, today's heresy could be tomorrow's orthodoxy. And thus the courts decided they're going to prescribe neither. Certain bizarre views, and admittedly they can be bizarre, at time get special protection under the principles of free exercise jurisprudence, because that's part of what religious freedom costs. You know, that Dr. Dawkins, who was adamantly opposed to all religions, he finds that too costly, proves only the shallowness of his worldview. It says nothing about the value that America places on the role of faith in society and what it's willing to sacrifice in order to protect that role. Now, no argument, of course, can be complete without invoking the children and what's best for the children. Daniel Dennett, in his book, Breaking the Spell, and guess what spell that is, warns about, quote, he warns about the effect of religious upbringing and education on children. He then even compares the religious education to parents letting their children drink alcohol. Let's see what he says here. He goes, when do the authorities have not just the right but the obligation to step in and prevent abuse? Tough questions, and they don't get easier when the topic is religion, not alcohol. So comparing parents teaching children religion to letting them drink booze, this is what we're dealing with here. In fact, Dawkins, you know, shows little respect even for such nuances. He argues that the damage to children caused by sexual abuse in some ways was arguably less than the long-term psychological damage inflicted upon them by, I think he says flat out here, by allowing them to, that inflicted by bringing the child up Catholic in the first place. Okay, he's saying that raising a child Catholic is as bad as sexual abuse. Now, Dawkins labels certain teachings, such as eternal torment and hell, as nothing but child abuse. He calls it child abuse. He also bemoans one of the most famous religious liberty cases in America, Wisconsin v. Yoder, in which the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the Amish to withdraw their children from school at the age of 16. And he just found that horrific. Now, let's be honest. There's no doubt when the issue of children arises, religious liberty has to be carefully balanced with other concerns. And the courts have wrestled for decades and decades with this difficult area. But what would the phrase religious freedom mean anywhere in any country if parents were not, except under the most extreme circumstances, given the ultimate say in fostering their children's religious beliefs, no matter how ludicrous those beliefs might seem to others? A free society can offer nothing less to its people and still justifiably call itself free. Now, these new atheists, too, they've also fallen into the error of what I have called, it's the myth of neutrality. Now, if Dawkins labeled the monstrous doctrine of eternal torment and hell, which really is, he labeled it as child abuse. Now, as a believer in the Bible, I totally reject the idea of eternal torment and hell. It's a perversion of the scripture. It's not a biblical teaching. It's a doctrine of our Father in hell. That's where it came from. But all that aside, you know, he's arguing against, you know, what he believes is the damage that could happen to children who are taught religion. Okay? But see, here's where I talk about the myth of neutrality. Children still need to be taught something about themselves, something about their origins, something about their destiny. Okay, he doesn't want them to teach him religion. Okay, that's fine. So what then would the new atheists, what then would they teach their children about how we got here, why we're here, the purpose of our lives? Because these are all questions that religion, for better or for worse, and I'll admit in some cases for worse, you know, teaches. What would the new atheist teach their children? Because remember, Dawkins is calling religious teachings child abuse, okay, or some religious teaching child abuse. So what would these atheists, these hardcore secularists and naturalists, what would they teach their children? Well, they teach them, we're created by chance, with no ultimate purpose or destiny, and that more conscious thought went into someone, you know, I don't know, doodling in the sand or spray painting on a wall than went into their existence? Children who lost siblings, who lose friends, or who lose parents, what are they going to teach them? They have to teach them that these people are gone forever. They have to teach them that there's no hope for ever seeing them again. The children will have to learn that they themselves and all their hopes and all their dreams and all their desires will one day be forever gone. They're going to live with no hope of redemption, no hope of having the hard answers, the hard questions answered, no hope of anything but what this life offers, the pain and the suffering of this life, followed by the eternal blackness of a cold and dead universe. That's all they can offer them. They can't give them any hope of any kind of final justice, no hope of any final rewards, no hope of any final reckoning, no hope of any balancing out the accounts, no hope of, you know, any kind of ultimate justice or punishment for the wicked. In their view, that the good and the bad all wind up in the same place. They offer them nothing but oblivion in the death of a universe that never saw us coming, doesn't care about us, and will not miss us or remember us when we're gone. See, that's what these people have to offer their children. And so I would say to Dr. Dawkins, be careful how you throw around the word child abuse, because child abuse could come in many different forms. And so I guess the question is now, what is all this? Where is all this coming from? How has all this arisen? What has spurred on this new atheism? What has spurred on this antipathy towards religion to the point where they're not just opposed to it, they want to restrict it. They're even talking about limiting what parents can even teach their children about religion. Well, in my opinion, the new atheism is nothing else but it's a hyperbolic reaction to the many excesses of religion, so painfully seen in recent years with, you know, among other things, suicide bombings and other atrocities done by the faithful. You see, for these atheists, there's only a quantitative difference between a believer who, hoping for a fast route to 70 virgins in paradise, blows up himself and others, and a believer who, using a fair amount of common sense, rejects the standard neo-Darwinian model of origins in favor of something like even intelligent design. In their view, for the new atheists, both these worldviews are completely alien to them, completely ridiculous to them. They have a single-tiered materialist conception of reality, which allows for nothing divine. They have a very narrow view of the world. Theirs is a world that has no room for the supernatural, no room for the spiritual, has no room for anything other than what life itself appears to here to be. We're no different than any other living creature, from bacteria to baboons. We're all just chemicals and molecules arranged by chance in a certain way, and sooner or later, we're all doomed to fade eternally from the scene. Now, fortunately, their views aren't likely to become public policy anytime soon, and certainly not here in the United States. You know, maybe other places, I don't know, you know. I mean, after all, look how well this kind of stuff worked in the former Soviet Union. I think the most damaging impact might be of them. I mean, they're not going to convert anybody. They're preaching to the choir. That's really what they're doing. I think the most damaging impact might be, though, the fertile fodder that they're providing the Christian right. See, the Christian right for decades now has been long trying to convince the flock that their religion is under attack by secular elites, and that the only way to protect themselves is for Christians to gain the reins of political power, and on and on and on. If you listen to the Christian right, you think all Christians were being persecuted under assault in America, and it's almost as nonsensical as the nonsense you got in here. If anything, I think in the end that the extremism of the new atheists will only feed the extremism of the Christian right, each side pushing the other further and further in directions that, quite frankly, I don't think neither really ought to go. No question, you look through history, religious people can do bad things. And if the past is any precursor to the future, or to the present is any precursor to the future, religious people are going to still continue to do bad things, even in the name of religion. But history shows us that secular people can be just as bad, or they could be even worse. Religious or secular, they can be just, look at all the things done in the past century by secular people in the name of no God, in the name of taking some of these views, this horrible hatred of religion, and determining to wipe it out. So I think in the end, what their polemics do is it reveals a Bible truth. It reveals a Bible truth about fallen humanity. How all of us, no matter our beliefs, if we're secular beliefs or sacred beliefs, it doesn't matter. If we're not careful, we can do some horrible things and promote some terrible views, all done in the name of enlightenment, in the name of progressive truth, in the name of science, and in the name of liberalism, in the name of free thought. We're the new atheist being a perfect example of how none of us, secular or sacred, are immune from this potential danger.